whisper, saying, "Hello, may I help you?" She was sharp, curt, like, "I do not have time for this." I told her I was hoping to talk to David, and she asked who was calling. "Rebecca," I said, afraid she'd hang up if I said anything more. "Just a moment." She sighed and lowered the phone. "Go take this to Day," she told the child. "Tell him he got a long-distance call. Somebody named Rebecca calling about his wife's cells." The child grabbed the phone, pressed it to his ear, and ran for Day. Then there was a long silence. "Pop, get up," the kid whispered. "There's somebody about your wife."
"What?"
"Get up. There's somebody about your wife's cells."
"What? Where?"
"Wife's cells. On the phone. Get up."
"Where are her cells?"
"Here," the boy said, handing Day the phone.
"Yeah."
"Hi, is this David Lax?"
"Yeah."
I told him my name and started to explain why I was calling, but before I could say much, he let out a deep sigh.
"What now this?"
he mumbled in a deep southern accent, his words slurred like he'd had a stroke.
"You got my wife's cells?"
"Yeah," I said, thinking he was asking if I was calling about his wife's cells.
"Yeah,"
he said, suddenly bright, alert.
"You got my wife's cells. She know you talking?"
"Yeah," I said, thinking he was asking if Deborah knew I was calling.
"Well, so let my old lady's cells talk to you and leave me alone," he snapped. "I had enough of you people."
Then he hung up. Chapter 7. The Death and Life of Cell Culture, 1951. On April 10, 1951, 3 weeks after Henrietta started radiation therapy, George Guy appeared on WAAM television in Baltimore for a special show devoted to his work. With dramatic music in the background, the announcer said, "Tonight, we will learn why scientists believe that cancer can be conquered." The camera flashed to Guy, sitting at a desk in front of a wall covered with pictures of cells. His face was long and handsome, with a pointed nose, black plastic bifocals, and a Charlie Chaplin mustache. He sat stiff and straight-backed, tweed suit perfectly pressed, white handkerchief in his breast pocket, hair slicked. His eyes darted off screen, then back to the camera as he drummed his fingers on the desk, his face expressionless.
"The normal cells which make up our bodies are tiny objects, 5,000 of which would fit on the head of a pin," he said, his voice a bit too loud and stilted. "How the normal cells become cancerous is still a mystery."
He gave viewers a basic overview of cell structure and cancer using diagrams and a long wooden pointer. He showed films of cells moving across the screen, their edges inching further and further into the empty space around them. And he zoomed in on one cancer cell, its edges round and smooth until it began to quiver and shake violently, exploding into 5 cancer cells. At one point, he said, "Now let me show you a bottle in which we have grown massive quantities of cancer cells." He picked up a clear glass pint-sized bottle, most likely full of Henrietta's cells, and rocked it in his hands as he explained that his lab was using those cells to find ways to stop cancer. He said,
"It is quite possible that from fundamental studies such as these, that we will be able to learn a way by which cancer cells can be damaged or completely wiped out."
To help make that happen, Guy began sending Henrietta's cells to any scientist who might use them for cancer research. Shipping live cells in the mail, a common practice today, wasn't done at the time. Instead, Guy sent them via planes in tubes with a few drops of culture medium, just enough to keep them alive for a short time. Sometimes pilots or stewards tucked the tubes into their shirt pockets to keep the cells at body temperature as if they were still in an incubator. Other times, when the cells had to ride in the cargo hold, Guy tucked them into holes carved in blocks of ice to keep them from overheating, then packed the ice in cardboard boxes filled with sawdust. When shipments were ready to go, Guy would warn recipients that the cells were about to metastasize to their cities so they could stand ready to fetch the shipment and rush back to their labs. If all went well, the cells survived. If not, Guy packaged up another batch and tried again.
He sent shipments of HeLa cells to researchers in Texas, India, New York, Amsterdam, and many places between. Those researchers gave them to more researchers, who gave them to more still. Henrietta's cells rode into the mountains of Chile in the saddlebags of pack mules. As Guy flew from one lab to another, demonstrating his culturing techniques and helping to set up new laboratories, he always flew with tubes of Henrietta's cells in his breast pocket. And when scientists visited Guy's lab to learn his techniques, he usually sent them home with a vial or two of HeLa. In letters, Guy and some of his colleagues began referring to the cells as his precious babies. The reason Henrietta's cells were so precious was because they allowed them to perform experiments that would have been impossible with a living human. They cut HeLa cells apart and exposed them to endless toxins, radiation, and infections. They bombarded them with drugs, hoping to find one that would kill malignant cells without destroying normal ones. They studied immune suppression and cancer growth by injecting HeLa cells into immune-compromised rats, which developed malignant tumors much like Henrietta's. If the cells died in the process, it didn't matter. Scientists could just go back to their eternally growing HeLa stock and start over again. Despite the spread of HeLa and the flurry of new research that followed, there were no news stories about the birth of the amazing HeLa cell line and how it might help stop cancer. In Guy's one appearance on television, he didn't mention Henrietta or her cells by name, so the general public knew nothing of HeLa. But even if they had known, they probably wouldn't have paid it much mind. For decades, the press had been reporting that cell culture was going to save the world from disease and make man immortal. But by 1951, the general public had stopped buying it. Cell culture had become less a medical miracle than something out of a scary science fiction movie. It all started on January 17, 1912, when Alexis Carrel, a French surgeon at the Rockefeller Institute, grew his immortal chicken heart. Scientists had been trying to grow living cells since before the turn of the century, but their samples had always died. As a result, many researchers believed it was impossible to keep tissues alive outside the body. But Carrel set out to prove them wrong. At age 39, he'd already invented the first technique for suturing blood vessels together, and had used it to perform the first coronary bypass and develop methods for transplanting organs. He hoped someday to grow whole organs in the laboratory, filling massive vaults with lungs, livers, kidneys, and tissues he could ship through the mail for transplantation. As a first step, he'd tried to grow a sliver of chicken heart tissue in culture. And to everyone's amazement, it worked. Those heart cells kept beating as if they were still in the chicken's body. Months later, Carrel won a Nobel Prize for his blood vessel suturing technique and his contributions to organ transplantation, and he became an instant celebrity. The prize had nothing to do with the chicken heart, but articles about his award conflated the immortal chicken heart cells with his transplantation work, and suddenly it sounded like he'd found the fountain of youth. Headlines around the world read, "Carrel's new miracle points way to avert old age. Scientists grow immortal chicken heart. Death, perhaps not inevitable. Scientists said Carell's chicken heart cells were one of the most important advances of the century, and that cell culture would uncover the secrets behind everything from eating and sex to the music of Bach, the poems of Milton, and the genius of Michelangelo. Carell was a scientific messiah. Magazines called his culture medium an elixir of youth and claimed that bathing in it might make a person live forever. But Carell wasn't interested in immortality for the masses. He was a eugenicist. Organ transplantation and life extension were ways to preserve what he saw as the superior white race, which he believed was being polluted by less intelligent and inferior stock, namely the poor, uneducated, and non-white. He dreamed of never-ending life for those he deemed worthy, and death or forced sterilization for everyone else. He'd later praise Hitler for the energetic measures he took in that direction. Carell's eccentricities fed into the media frenzy about his work. He was a stout, fast-talking Frenchman with mismatched eyes, one brown, the other blue, who rarely went out without his surgeon's cap. He wrongly believed that light could kill cell cultures, so his laboratory looked like the photo negative of a Ku Klux Klan rally, where technicians worked in long black robes, heads covered in black hoods with small slits cut for their eyes. They sat on black stools at black tables in a shadowless room with floors, ceilings, and walls painted black. The only illumination came from a small, dust-covered skylight. Carell was a mystic who believed in telepathy and clairvoyance, and thought it was possible for humans to live several centuries through the use of suspended animation. Eventually, he turned his apartment into a chapel, began giving lectures on medical miracles, and told reporters he dreamed of moving to South America and becoming a dictator. Other researchers distanced themselves, criticizing him for being unscientific. But much of white America embraced his ideas and saw him as a spiritual advisor and a genius. Reader's Digest ran articles by Carell advising women that a husband should not be induced by an oversexed wife to perform a sexual act, since sex drained the mind. In his best-selling book, Man the Unknown, he proposed fixing what he believed was an error in the U.S. Constitution that promised equality for all people. The feeble-minded and the man of genius should not be equal before the law, he wrote. The stupid, the unintelligent, those who are dispersed, incapable of attention, of effort, have no right to a higher education. His book sold more than 2 million copies and was translated into 20 languages. Thousands showed up for Carell's talks, sometimes requiring police in riot gear to keep order as buildings filled to capacity and fans had to be turned away. Through all of this, the press and public remained obsessed with Carell's immortal chicken heart. Each year on New Year's Day, the New York World Telegram called Carell to check on the cells. And every January 17th for decades, when Carell and his assistants lined up in their black suits to sing Happy Birthday to the cells, some newspaper or magazine retold the same story again and again. Chicken heart cells alive 10 years, 14 years, 20. Each time, the stories promised the cells would change the face of medicine. But they never did. Meanwhile, Carell's claims about the cells grew more fantastical. At one point, he said, the cells would reach a volume greater than that of the solar system. The Literary Digest reported that the cells could have already covered the Earth, and a British tabloid said they could form a rooster big enough today to cross the Atlantic in a single stride, a bird so monstrous that when perched on this mundane sphere, the world, it would look like a weathercock. A string of best-selling books warned of the dangers of tissue culture. One predicted that 70% of babies would soon be grown in culture,
Another imagined tissue culture producing giant Negroes and two-headed toads. But the fear of tissue culture truly found its way into American living rooms in an episode of Lights Out, a 1930s radio horror show that told the story of a fictional Dr. Alberts who'd created an immortal chicken heart in his lab. It grew out of control, filling the city streets like the Blob, consuming everyone and everything in its path. In only 2 weeks, it destroyed the entire country. The real chicken heart cells didn't fare so well. In fact, it turned out that the original cells had probably never survived long at all. Years after Carell died, awaiting trial for collaborating with the Nazis, scientist Leonard Hayflick grew suspicious of the chicken heart. No one had ever been able to replicate Carell's work, and the cells seemed to defy a basic rule of biology, that normal cells can only divide a finite number of times before dying. Hayflick investigated them and concluded that the original chicken heart cells had actually died soon after Carell put them in culture, and that, intentionally or not, Carell had been putting new cells in the culture dishes each time he fed them using an embryo juice he made from ground tissues. At least one of Carell's former lab assistants verified Hayflick's suspicion. But no one could test the theory, because 2 years after Carell's death, his assistant unceremoniously threw the famous chicken heart cells in the trash. Either way, by 1951, when Henrietta Lacks's cells began growing in the Guy lab, just 5 years after the widely publicized death of Carell's chicken heart, the public image of immortal cells was tarnished. Tissue culture was the stuff of racism, creepy science fiction, Nazis, and snake oil. It wasn't something to be celebrated. In fact, no one paid much attention to it at all. Chapter 8, A Miserable Specimen, 1951. In early June, Henrietta told her doctor several times that she thought the cancer was spreading, that she could feel it moving through her, but they found nothing wrong with her. "The patient states that she feels fairly well," one doctor wrote in her chart. "However, she continues to complain of some vague lower abdominal discomfort. No evidence of recurrence. Return in 1 month." There's no indication that Henrietta questioned him. Like most patients in the 1950s, she deferred to anything her doctor said. This was a time when benevolent deception was a common practice. Doctors often withheld even the most fundamental information from their patients, sometimes not giving them any diagnosis at all. They believed it was best not to confuse or upset patients with frightening terms they might not understand, like cancer. Doctors knew best, and most patients didn't question that, especially black patients in public wards. This was 1951 in Baltimore. Segregation was law, and it was understood that black people didn't question white people's professional judgment. Many black patients were just glad to be getting treatment, since discrimination in hospitals was widespread. There's no way of knowing whether or how Henrietta's treatment would have differed if she'd been white. According to Howard Jones, Henrietta got the same care any white patient would have. The biopsy, the radium treatment, and radiation were all standard for the day. But several studies have shown that black patients were treated and hospitalized at later stages of their illnesses than white patients. And once hospitalized, they got fewer pain medications and had higher mortality rates. All we can know for sure are the facts of Henrietta's medical records. A few weeks after the doctor told her she was fine, she went back to Hopkins saying that the discomfort she'd complained about last time was now an ache in both sides. But the doctor's entry was identical to the one weeks earlier. "No evidence of recurrence. Return in 1 month." 2.5 weeks later, Henrietta's abdomen hurt, and she could barely urinate. The pain made it hard to walk. She went back to Hopkins, where a doctor passed a catheter to empty her bladder, then sent her home. 3 days later, when she returned complaining once again of pain, a doctor pressed on her abdomen and felt a stony, hard mass. An X-ray showed that it was attached to her pelvic wall, nearly blocking her urethra. The doctor on duty called for Jones and several others who'd treated Henrietta. They all examined her and looked at the X-ray. "Inoperable," they said. Only weeks after a previous entry declared her healthy, one of the doctors wrote, "The patient looks chronically ill. She is obviously in pain." He sent her home to bed. Sadie would later describe Henrietta's decline like this. "Henny didn't fade away, you know? Her looks, her body. It didn't just fade. Like some people's be sick in the bed with cancer, and they look so bad. But she didn't. The only thing you could tell was in her eyes. Her eyes were telling you that she wasn't going to be alive no more." Until that point, no one except Sadie, Margaret, and Day knew Henrietta was sick. Then suddenly everyone knew. When Day and the cousins walked home from Sparrow's Point after each shift, they could hear Henrietta from a block away, wailing for the Lord to help her. When Day drove her back to Hopkins for X-rays the following week, stone-hard tumors filled the inside of her abdomen, one on her uterus, one on each kidney, and on her urethra. Just a month after a note in her medical record said she was fine, another doctor wrote, "In view of the rapid extension of the disease process, the outlook is quite poor. The only option," he said, "was further irradiation in the hopes that we may at least relieve her pain." Henrietta couldn't walk from the house to the car, but either Day or one of the cousins managed to get her to Hopkins every day for radiation. They didn't realize she was dying. They thought the doctors were still trying to cure her. Each day, Henrietta's doctors increased her dose of radiation, hoping it would shrink the tumors and ease the pain until her death. Each day, the skin on her abdomen burned blacker and blacker, and the pain grew worse. On August 8th, just 1 week after her 31st birthday, Henrietta arrived at Hopkins for her treatment, but this time she said she wanted to stay. Her doctor wrote, "Patient has been complaining bitterly of pain, and she seems genuinely miserable. She has to come in from a considerable distance, and it is felt that she deserves to be in the hospital where she can be better cared for." After Henrietta checked into the hospital, a nurse drew blood and labeled the vial colored, then stored it in case Henrietta needed transfusions later. A doctor put Henrietta's feet in stirrups once again to take a few more cells from her cervix at the request of George Guy, who wanted to see if a second batch would grow like the first. But Henrietta's body had become so contaminated with toxins normally flushed from the system in urine, her cells died immediately in culture. During Henrietta's first few days in the hospital, the children came with Day to visit her, but when they left, she cried and moaned for hours. Soon the nurses told Day he couldn't bring the children anymore because it upset Henrietta too much. After that, Day would park the Buick behind Hopkins at the same time each day and sit on a little patch of grass on Wolf Street with the children right under Henrietta's window. She'd pull herself out of bed, press her hands and face to the glass, and watch her children play on the lawn. But within days, Henrietta couldn't get herself to the window anymore. Her doctors tried in vain to ease her suffering. "Demerol does not seem to touch the pain," one wrote, so he tried morphine. "This doesn't help too much either." He gave her Dromaran. "This stuff works," he wrote, but not for long. Eventually, one of her doctors tried injecting pure alcohol straight into her spine. "Alcohol injections ended in failure," he wrote. New tumors seemed to appear daily, on her lymph nodes, hip bones, labia, and she spent most days with a fever up to 105. Her doctor stopped the radiation treatment and seemed as defeated by the cancer as she was. "Henrietta is still a miserable specimen," they wrote. "She groans. She is constantly nauseated and claims she vomits everything she eats. Patient acutely upset, very anxious. As far as I can see, we are doing all that can be done." There is no record that George Guy ever visited Henrietta in the hospital or said anything to her about her cells, and everyone I talked to who might know said that Guy and Henrietta never met. Everyone, that is, except Laura Aurelian, a microbiologist who was Guy's colleague at Hopkins.
"I'll never forget it," Aurelian said. "George told me. He leaned over Henrietta's bed and said, 'Your cells will make you immortal.' He told Henrietta her cells would help save the lives of countless people. And she smiled. She told him she was glad her pain would come to some good for someone."
Chapter 9. Turner Station, 1999. A few days after my first conversation with Day, I drove from Pittsburgh to Baltimore to meet his son, David "Sonny" Lax Jr. He'd finally called me back and agreed to meet, saying he'd gotten worn out from my number showing up on his pager. I didn't know it then, but he'd made 5 panicked phone calls to Patillo asking questions about me before calling. The plan was that I'd page Sonny when I got to Baltimore, then he'd pick me up and take me to his brother Lawrence's house to meet their father, and if I was lucky, Deborah. So I checked into the downtown Holiday Inn, sat on the bed, phone in my lap, and dialed Sonny's pager. No reply. I stared through my hotel window at a tall, gothic-looking brick tower across the street with a huge clock at the top. It was a weather-beaten silver, with big letters spelling Bromo Seltzer in a circle around its face. I watched the hands move slowly past the letters, paged Sonny every few minutes, and waited for the phone to ring. Eventually, I grabbed the fat Baltimore phone book, opened to the L's, and ran my finger down a long line of names. Annette Lax, Charles Lax. I figured I'd call every Lax in the book asking if they knew Henrietta. But I didn't have a cell phone and didn't want to tie up the line, so I paged Sonny again, then lay back on the bed, phone and white pages still in my lap. I started rereading a yellowed copy of a 1976 Rolling Stone article about the Laxes by a writer named Michael Rogers, the first reporter ever to contact Henrietta's family. I'd read it many times, but wanted every word fresh in my mind. Halfway through the article, Rogers wrote, "I am sitting on the 7th floor of the downtown Baltimore Holiday Inn. Through the thermopane picture window is a huge public clock in which the numerals have been replaced by the characters Bromo Seltzer. In my lap is a telephone and the Baltimore White Pages." I bolted upright, suddenly feeling like I'd been sucked into a Twilight Zone episode. More than 2 decades earlier, when I was just 3 years old, Rogers had gone through those same white pages. Halfway through the Lax listings, it becomes clear that just about everybody had known Henrietta, he wrote. So I opened the phone book again and started dialing, hoping I'd find one of those people who knew her. But they didn't answer their phones, they hung up on me, or they said they'd never heard of Henrietta. I dug out an old newspaper article where I'd seen Henrietta's Turner Station address, 713 New Pittsburgh Avenue. I looked at 4 maps before finding one where Turner Station wasn't covered by ads or blow-up grids of other neighborhoods. It turned out Turner Station wasn't just hidden on the map.
To get there, I had to drive past the cement wall and fence that blocked it from the interstate, across a set of tracks, past churches and old storefronts, rows of boarded-up houses, and a buzzing electrical generator as big as a football field. Finally, I saw a dark wooden sign saying, "Welcome to Turner's Station," in the parking lot of a fire-scorched bar with pink tasseled curtains. To this day, no one's entirely sure what the town is actually called or how to spell it. Sometimes it's plural, Turner's Station, other times possessive, Turner's apostrophe S Station, but most often it's singular, Turner Station. It was originally deeded as Good Luck, but never quite lived up to the name. When Henrietta arrived there in the 40s, the town was booming. But the end of World War II brought cutbacks at Sparrows Point. Baltimore Gas and Electric demolished 300 homes to make room for a new power plant, leaving more than 1,300 homeless, most of them black. More and more land was zoned for industrial use, which meant more houses torn down. People fled for East Baltimore or back to the country, and the population of Turner Station dropped by half before the end of the 50s. By the time I got there, it was about 1,000 and falling steadily because there were few jobs. In Henrietta's day, Turner Station was a town where you never locked your doors. Now there was a housing project surrounded by a 13,000-foot-long brick and cement security wall in the field where Henrietta's children once played. Stores, nightclubs, cafes, and schools had closed, and drug dealers, gangs, and violence were on the rise. But Turner Station still had more than 10 churches. The newspaper article where I'd gotten Henrietta's address quoted a local woman, Courtney Speed, who owned a grocery store and had created a foundation devoted to building a Henrietta Lacks Museum. But when I got to the lot where Speed's grocery was supposed to be, I found a gray, rust-stained mobile home, its broken windows covered with wire. The sign out front had a single red rose painted on it, and the words, "Reviving the Spirit to Recapture the Vision," Proverbs 29:18. Six men gathered on the front steps, laughing. The oldest, in his 30s, wore red slacks, red suspenders, a black shirt, and a driving cap. Another wore an oversized red and white ski jacket. They were surrounded by younger men of various shades of brown and sagging pants. The two men in red stopped talking, watched me drive by slowly, then kept on laughing. Turner Station is less than a mile across in any direction, its horizon lined with skyscraper-sized shipping cranes and smokestacks billowing thick clouds from Sparrows Point. As I drove in circles, looking for Speed's grocery, children stopped playing in the streets to stare and wave. They ran between matching red brick houses and past women hanging fresh laundry, following me as their mothers smiled and waved too. I drove by the trailer with the men out front so many times, they started waving at me with each pass. I did the same with Henrietta's old house. It was a unit in a brown brick building divided into four homes, with a chain link fence, several feet of grass out front, and three steps leading up to a small cement stoop. A child watched me from behind Henrietta's old screen door, waving and playing with a stick. I waved back at everyone and feigned surprise each time the group of children following me appeared on various streets, grinning, but I didn't stop and ask for help. I was too nervous. The people of Turner Station just watched me, smiling and shaking their heads like, "What's that young white girl doing driving around in circles?" Finally, I saw the new Shiloh Baptist Church, which the newspaper article had mentioned as the site of community meetings about the Henrietta Lacks Museum. But it was closed. As I pressed my face to the tall glass out front, a black town car pulled up, and a smooth, handsome man in his 40s jumped out,
with gold-tinted glasses, black suit, black beret, and the keys to the church. He slid his glasses to the end of his nose and looked me over, asking if I needed help. I told him why I was there. "Never heard of Henrietta Lacks," he said. "Not many people have," I said, and told him I'd read that someone had hung a plaque in Henrietta's honor at Speed's Grocery.
"Oh, Speed's,"
he said, suddenly all smiles and a hand on my shoulder.
"I can take you to Speed's."
He told me to get in my car and follow him. Everyone on the street waved and yelled as we passed.
"Hi, Reverend Jackson. How you doing, Reverend?"
He nodded and yelled right back,
"How you doing? God bless you."
Just two blocks away, we stopped in front of that gray trailer with the men out front, and the Reverend jammed his car into park, waving for me to get out. The cluster of men on the steps smiled, grabbed the pastor's hand, and gave it two-handed shake, saying,
"Hey, Reverend, you brought a friend?" "Yes, I did," he told them. "She's here to talk to Ms. Speed."
The one in the red pants and red suspenders, who turned out to be Speed's oldest son, Keith, said she was out, and who knew when she'd be back, so I may as well grab a seat on the porch with the boys and wait. As I sat down, the man in the red and white ski jacket smiled a big bright smile, then told me he was her son Mike. Then there were her sons Cyrus and Joe and Tyrone. Every man on that porch was her son. So was nearly every man that walked in the store. Pretty soon, I'd counted 15 sons and said, "Wait a minute, she's got 15 kids?"
"Oh," Mike yelled, "you don't know Mama Speed, do you? Oh, I look up to Mama. She tough. She keep Turner Station in line, boy. She fears no man."
The men on the porch all nodded and said,
"That's right. Don't you get scared if anybody come in here trying to attack Mama when we're not around," Mike said, "'cause she'll scare them to death."
Speed's sons let out a chorus of amens as Mike told a story, saying,
"This man came in the store once, yelling, 'I'm gonna come across that counter and get you.' I was hiding behind Mama, I was so scared. And you know what Mama did? She rocked her head and raised up them arms and said, 'Come on, come on. If you think you crazy, you just try it.'"
Mike slapped me on the back, and all the sons laughed. At that moment, Courtney Speed appeared at the bottom of the steps, her long black hair piled loose on her head, strands hanging in wisps around her face, which was thin, beautiful, and entirely ageless. Her eyes were soft brown with a perfect halo of sea blue around the edges. She was delicate, not a hard edge on her. She hugged a grocery bag to her chest and whispered,
"But did that man jump across that counter at me?"
Mike screamed and laughed so hard he couldn't answer. She looked at him, calm and smiling.
"I said, did that man jump?"
"No, he did not,"
Mike said, grinning.
"That man didn't do nothing but run. That's why Mama got no gun in this store. She don't need one."
"I don't live by the gun," she said, then turned to me and smiled. "How you doing?"
She walked up the stairs into the store, and we all followed.
"Mama," Keith said, "Pastor brought this woman in here. She's Miss Rebecca, and she's here to talk to you."
Courtney Speed smiled a beautiful, almost bashful smile, her eyes bright and motherly.
"God bless you, sweetie," she said.
Inside, flattened cardboard boxes covered most of the floor, which was worn from years of foot traffic. Shelves lined each wall, some bare, others stacked with Wonder Bread, rice, toilet paper, and pig's feet. On one, Speed had piled hundreds of editions of the Baltimore Sun dating back to the 1970s, when her husband died. She said she'd given up replacing the windows each time someone broke in because they'd just do it again. She'd hung handwritten signs on every wall of the store, One for Sam the Man snowballs, others for sports clubs, church groups, and free GED and adult literacy classes. She had dozens of spiritual sons, who she treated no different than her 6 biological sons. And when any child came in to buy chips, candy, or soda, Speed made them calculate how much change she owed them. They got a free Hershey's Kiss for each correct answer. Speed started straightening the items on her shelves so each label faced out, then yelled over her shoulder at me, "How did you find your way here?" I told her about the 4 maps, and she threw a box of lard onto the shelf.
"Now we got the 4 map syndrome," she said. "They keep trying to push us off the earth, but God won't let them. Praise the Lord, He brings us the people we really need to talk to."
She wiped her hands on her white shirt.
"Now that He brought you here, what can I do for you?"
"I'm hoping to learn about Henrietta Lacks," I said. Courtney gasped, her face suddenly ashen. She took several steps back and hissed, "You know Mr. Cofield? Did he send you?" I was confused. I told her I'd never heard of Cofield and no one had sent me.
"How did you know about me?"
she snapped, backing away further. I pulled the old crumpled newspaper article from my purse and handed it to her.
"Have you talked to the family?"
she asked. "I'm trying," I said. "I talked to Deborah once, and I was supposed to meet Sonny today, but he didn't show up." She nodded like, "I knew it."
"I can't tell you anything until you got the support of the family. I can't risk that."
"What about the plaque you got for the museum?" I asked. "Can I see that?"
"It's not here," she snapped. "Nothing's here because bad things happened around all that."
She looked at me for a long moment. Then her face softened. She took my hand in one of hers and touched my face with the other.
"I like your eyes," she said. "Come with me."
She hurried out the door and down the stairs to her old brown station wagon. A man sat in the passenger seat, staring straight at the road as if the car were moving. He didn't look up as she jumped in, saying,
"Follow me."
We drove through Turner Station to the parking lot of the local public library. As I opened my car door, Courtney appeared, clapping, grinning, and bouncing on her tiptoes. Words erupted from her.
"February 1st is Henrietta Lacks Day here in Baltimore County," she said. "This February 1st is going to be the big kickoff event here at the library. We're still trying to put a museum together, even though the Cofield situation did cause so many problems. Terrified, Deborah. We were supposed to be almost done with the museum by now. We were so close before all that horribleness. But I'm glad he sent you," she said, pointing to the sky. "This story just got to be told. Praise the Lord, people got to know about Henrietta."
"Who's Cofield?" I asked. She cringed and slapped her hand over her mouth.
"I really can't talk until the family says it's okay," she said,
then grabbed my hand and ran into the library.
"This is Rebecca," she told the librarian, bouncing on her toes again. "She's writing about Henrietta Lacks."
"Oh, that is wonderful," the librarian said. Then she looked at Courtney.
"Are you talking to her?" "I need the tape," Courtney said.
The librarian walked down a row of videos, pulled a white box from the shelf, and handed it to her. Courtney tucked the video under her arm, grabbed my hand, and ran me back to the parking lot, where she jumped into her car and sped off, waving for me to follow. We stopped outside a convenience store while the man in her front seat got out and bought a loaf of bread. Then we dropped him off in front of his house as Courtney yelled back to me,
"He's my deaf cousin. Can't drive."
Finally, she led me to a small beauty parlor she owned, not far from Speed's grocery. She unlocked 2 bolts on the front door and waved her hand in the air, saying,
"Smells like I got a mouse in one of those traps."
The shop was narrow, with barber chairs lining one wall and dryers along the other. The hair-washing sink, propped up with a piece of plywood, drained into a large white bucket. The walls around it splattered with years' worth of hair dye. Next to the sink sat a price board. Cut and style, $10. Press and curl, $7. And against the back wall, on top of a supply cabinet, sat a photocopy of the picture of Henrietta Lacks, hands on hips, in a pale wood frame several inches too big. I pointed to the photo and raised my eyebrows. Courtney shook her head. "I'll tell you everything I know," she whispered, "just as soon as you talk to the family and they say it's okay. I don't want any more problems, and I don't want Deborah to get sick over it again." She pointed to a cracked red vinyl barber's chair, which she spun to face a small television next to the hair dryers. "You have to watch this tape," she said, handing me the remote and a set of keys. She started to walk out the door, then turned. "Don't you open this door for nothing or nobody but me. You hear?" she said. "And don't you miss nothing in that video. Use that rewind button. Watch it twice if you have to, but don't you miss nothing." Then she left, locking the door behind her. What rolled in front of me on that television screen was a one-hour BBC documentary about Henrietta and the HeLa cells called The Way of All Flesh, which I'd been trying to get a copy of for months. It opened to sweet music and a young black woman who wasn't Henrietta dancing in front of the camera. A British man began narrating, his voice melodramatic, like he was telling a ghost story that just might be true. "In 1951, a woman died in Baltimore in America," he said, pausing for effect. "She was called Henrietta Lacks." The music grew louder and more sinister as he told the story of her cells. "These cells have transformed modern medicine. They shaped the policies of countries and of presidents. They even became involved in the Cold War. Because scientists were convinced that in her cells lay the secret of how to conquer death." What really grabbed me was footage of Clover, an old plantation town in southern Virginia where some of Henrietta's relatives still seemed to live. The last image to appear on the screen was Henrietta's cousin Fred Garrett, standing behind an old slave shack in Clover, his back to the family cemetery where, the narrator said, Henrietta lay buried in an unmarked grave. Fred pointed to the cemetery and looked hard into the camera. "Do you think them cells still living?" he asked. "I talking about in the grave." He paused, then laughed a long rumbling laugh. "Hell no," he said. "I don't guess they are. But they're still living out in the test tubes. That's a miracle." The screen went blank, and I realized if Henrietta's children and husband wouldn't talk to me, I needed to visit Clover and find her cousins. That night, back at the hotel, I finally got Sonny on the phone. He said he'd decided not to meet me, but wouldn't tell me why. When I asked him to put me in touch with his family in Clover, he told me to go there and find them myself. Then he laughed and wished me luck. Chapter 10. The Other Side of the Tracks, 1999. Clover sits a few rolling hills off Route 360 in southern Virginia, just past Difficult Creek on the banks of the River of Death. I pulled into town under a blue December sky, with air warm enough for May, a yellow post-it note with the only information Sonny had given me stuck on my dashboard. "They haven't found her grave. Make sure it's day. There are no lights. Gets darker than dark. Ask anybody where Laxtown is." Downtown Clover started at a boarded-up gas station with R.I.P. spray-painted across its front, and ended at an empty lot that once held the depot where Henrietta caught her train to Baltimore. The roof of the old movie theater on Main Street had caved in years ago, its screen landing flat in a field of weeds. The other businesses looked like someone left for lunch decades earlier and never bothered coming back. One wall of Abbott's clothing store was lined with boxes of new Red Wing work boots stacked to the ceiling and covered in thick dust. Inside its long glass counter, beneath an antique cash register, lay rows and rows of men's dress shirts, still folded starch stiff in their plastic. The lounge at Rosie's restaurant was filled with overstuffed chairs, couches, and shag carpet, all dust-covered browns, oranges, and yellows. A sign in the front window said, "Open 7 days," just above one that said, "Closed." At Gregory and Martin Supermarket, half-full shopping carts rested in the aisles next to decades-old canned foods, and the wall clock hadn't moved past 6:34 since Martin closed up shop to become an undertaker sometime in the 80s. Even with kids on drugs and the older generation dying off, Clover didn't have enough death to keep an undertaker in business. In 1974, it had a population of 227. In 1998, it was 198. That same year, Clover lost its town charter. It did still have several churches and a few beauty parlors, but they were rarely open. The only steady business left downtown was the one-room brick post office, but it was closed when I got there. Main Street felt like a place where you could sit for hours without seeing a pedestrian or a car. But a man stood in front of Rosie's, leaning against his red motorized bicycle, waiting to wave at any cars that might pass. He was a short, round, white man with red cheeks who could have been anywhere from 50 to 70. Locals called him the greeter, and he'd spent most of his life on that corner waving at anyone who drove by, his face expressionless. I asked if he could direct me to Laxtown, where I planned to look for mailboxes with the name Lax on them, then knock on doors asking about Henrietta. The man never said a word, just waved at me, then slowly pointed behind him across the tracks. The dividing line between Laxtown and the rest of Clover was stark. On one side of the two-lane road from downtown, there were vast, well-manicured rolling hills, acres and acres of wide-open property with horses, a small pond, a well-kept house set back from the road, a minivan, and a white picket fence. Directly across the street stood a small one-room shack about 7 feet wide and 12 feet long. It was made of unpainted wood, with large gaps between the wallboards where vines and weeds grew. That shack was the beginning of Laxtown, a single road about a mile long and lined with dozens of houses, some painted bright yellows or greens, others unpainted, half caved in or nearly burnt down. Slave-era cabins sat next to cinder block homes and trailers, some with satellite dishes and porch swings, others rusted and half buried. I drove the length of Laxtown Road again and again, past the end-of-state maintenance sign where the road turned to gravel, past a tobacco field with a basketball court in it, just a patch of red dirt and a bare hoop attached to the top of a weathered tree trunk. The muffler on my beat-up black Honda had fallen off somewhere between Pittsburgh and Clover, which meant everyone in Laxtown heard each time I passed. They walked onto porches and peered through windows as I drove by. Finally, on my third or fourth pass, a man who looked like he was in his 70s shuffled out of a green, two-room wooden cabin wearing a bright green sweater, a matching scarf, and a black driving cap. He waved a stiff arm at me, eyebrows raised. "You lost?" he yelled over my muffler. I rolled down my window and said, "Not exactly." "Well, where are you trying to go?" he said,
'cause I know you're not from around here.
I asked him if he'd heard of Henrietta. He smiled and introduced himself as Cootie, Henrietta's first cousin. His real name was Hector Henry. People started calling him Cootie when he got polio decades earlier. He was never sure why. Cootie's skin was light enough to pass for Latino, so when he got sick at 9 years old, a local white doctor snuck him into the nearest hospital, saying Cootie was his son, since the hospitals didn't treat black patients. Cootie spent a year inside an iron lung that breathed for him, and he'd been in and out of hospitals ever since. The polio had left him partially paralyzed in his neck and arms, with nerve damage that caused constant pain. He wore a scarf regardless of the weather, because the warmth helped ease the pain. I told him why I was there, and he pointed up and down the road.
Everybody in Laxtown kin to Henrietta, but she been gone so long, even her memory pretty much dead now, he said. Everything about Henrietta dead, except them cells.
He pointed to my car.
Turn this loud thing off and come inside. I'll fix you some juice.
His front door opened into a tiny kitchen with a coffee maker, a vintage toaster, and an old wood stove with two cooking pots on top, one empty, the other filled with chili. He'd painted the kitchen walls the same dark olive green as the outside and lined them with power strips and fly swatters. He'd recently gotten indoor plumbing, but still preferred the outhouse. Though Cootie could barely move his arms, he'd built the house on his own, teaching himself construction as he went along, hammering the plywood walls and plastering the inside. But he'd forgotten to use insulation, so soon after he finished it, he tore down the walls and started over again. A few years after that, the whole place burned down when he fell asleep under an electric blanket. But he built it back up again. The walls were a bit crooked, he said, but he'd used so many nails, he didn't think it would ever fall down. Cootie handed me a glass of red juice and shooed me out of the kitchen into his dark wood-paneled living room. There was no couch, just a few metal folding chairs and a barber's chair anchored to the linoleum floor, its cushions covered entirely with duct tape. Cootie had been the Laxtown barber for decades.
That chair costs $1,200 now, but I got it for $8 back then, he yelled from the kitchen. Haircut wasn't but a dollar. Sometimes I cut 58 heads in one day.
Eventually he quit because he couldn't hold his arms up long enough to cut. A small boombox leaned against one wall blaring a gospel call-in show with a preacher screaming something about the Lord curing a caller of hepatitis. Cootie opened a folding chair for me, then walked into his bedroom. He lifted his mattress with one arm, propped it on his head, and began rummaging through piles of paper hidden beneath it.
I know I got some information on Henrietta in here somewhere, he mumbled from under the mattress. Where the hell I put that? You know other countries be buying her for $25, sometimes $50? Her family didn't get no money out of it.
After digging through what looked like hundreds of papers, he came back to the living room.
This here the only picture I got of her, he said, pointing to a copy of the Rolling Stone article with the ever-present hands-on-hips photo. I don't know what to say. Only education I got, I had to learn on my own. But I always couldn't count, and I can't hardly read or write my name 'cause my hand's so jittery.
He asked if the article said anything about her childhood in Clover. I shook my head no.
Everybody liked Henrietta, 'cause she was a very good-conditioned person, he said. She just lovey-dovey, always smiling, always taking care of us when we come to the house. Even after she got sick, she never was a person who say, I feel bad and I'm going to take it out on you. She wasn't like that, even when she hurtin'. But she didn't seem to understand what was going on. She didn't want to think she was gonna die.
He
He shook his head. You know, they said if we could get all the pieces of her together, she'd weigh over 800 pounds now, he told me. And Henrietta never was a big girl.